This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Bill Barich, the author of Long Way Home, On the Trail of Steinbeck's America. Hi, Bill. How are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
So I think, inevitably we have to start with Steinbeck, which is the kind of, the model upon which you based this book. Considerably different because he wrote in 1962 and you went on the road in 2008. But I guess, the first question that you have to ask is, what did in fact get you to decide to leave Ireland where you live and go out on the road for this long of a time all by yourself, basically, for almost 6,000 miles?
Well, it was really serendipity. I was feeling kind of nostalgic for the States, and it was obviously a time of great turmoil in the early autumn of 2008. And I, just by chance, I happened to fall on a copy of Travels with Charlie at a sort of thrift store in Dublin, and I thought, well, that's great. I haven't read that book since I was a kid, and I really loved the notion of being on the road. And I brought it home, and I began to read it, and my memory proved to be entirely inaccurate. And when I read it in my teens, I had missed some of the bitterness and some of the melancholy that runs, throughout the book. And I was puzzled about, how Steinbeck had reached that point in his life. So I looked into a volume of his collected letters. And when he wrote about that trip to Pascal Covici, who was his editor at Viking, he was far more forthcoming about his dismal view of America and its future. And he said something like it reminded him of a corpse that was full of gases, and that when those gases explode, he didn't want to be around.
That's so pretty evocative image.
Terrible. I mean, deeply, deeply pessimistic. And I thought, well, here it is. We're in financial ruin. The country is appears to be rudderless. And then there were so many overlaps, I've lived in California most before going to Ireland most of my adult life, and many of my books are set there. And it was almost 50 years after Steinbeck's trip, and it was also he traveled just before the Kennedy-Nixon election, and which was again a sort of turning point for the country. And I thought we were facing the same kind of divide again with Obama and McCain. So all of these things kind of came together in such a way that I thought, well, maybe I should go and really sort of test these prophetic words of Steinbeck's and see how accurate he was. I didn't want to go and buy a camper and get a dog and do a sort of nostalgic rerun. It was really just the inspiration and the prophecy that motivated.
Right. So essentially, literally, you were not copying what he did, but it's more kind of a spiritual precursor, and it gives you a kind of motif against which you can compare what you see along the way.
Well, there's a great deal in the book of just sort of debating and sometimes arguing with Steinbeck and saying, and he himself had, he had arguments about, what he was perceiving and just how accurate it could be, or was it in fact his health was not really very good, and could it be attributed to that? So it's sometimes it's a debate, sometimes it's a dialogue, but throughout the book there are references to Steinbeck's state of mind.
And of course, his trip, he drove, as you point out later, which I really didn't realize, he drove a pickup truck with a, kind of camper shell on the back of it, and lived in that for, a pretty long period of time. Whereas you drove a rental car and stayed in motels mostly, which I think maybe created a more social environment for you and a less kind of separated, if you're sleeping in your truck, somehow you're not engaging with people quite in the same way.
Well, it's fascinating. In the letters there, when Steinbeck, when he begins, he first hits on this idea. He'd been in a very stale period as a writer. And he writes a letter to some friends and says, I'm going to buy this truck and I'm going to go camp, specially made. I'm going to go across the country. And then when he proposes this to his agent, a woman named Elizabeth Otis, she writes back and she says pretty much what you're saying. She says, John, this is like, you're not going to talk to anybody. You should go by bus or stay in motels. And Steinbeck wrote back this letter that verges on the irrational, you know, where he says, I have to travel in this camper because it will be my home. And when people are in motels, they're not like they are at home. But when they come into my home, we'll be at home. and it kind of goes on like that.
Which is, of course, ludicrous.
It was, you know. And then, you know, the other thing that was striking is when you read the book, I think it's his first day on the road, he stops at a liquor store in Connecticut and buys, you know, enough, as I say in the book, enough of booze to float a fraternity party. So there's a certain implication that he didn't really engage in the way that he had hoped to, and became more and more depressed. As one of his sons said that he and his brother both believe that Steinbeck basically made up, you know, most of the dialogue in the book, and I would be, you know, just reading it, inclined to agree.
Well, it seems, yeah. You and he are very different in that way. I mean, I don't know. Obviously, I've never met you, but I think I got a really, you know, you come across as a person throughout this book. I was really struck by your ability. I'm not quite sure how to put words to this correctly, but I thought that you were incredibly personal at the same time as you were reporting, and that your personality did not dominate. So I was, as the reader, able to get to know you as a person, understand who you are and what your thinking is through the lens of your talking about people that you met along the way. And, you know, you're not the invisible journalist, the sort of classic notion of, you know, simply reporting what you see. You're obviously part of the story. It's your story as well as the people that you see. So you kind of work a really interesting balance between subjectivity and objectivity, which I thought was, you know, pretty, it's very attractive to me in terms of reading the book.
Well, thank you. I mean, I've tried to do that in all my books. I mean, I think that, you know, we were saying just before we went on, we started recording it, that, you know, let's just have a conversation. And that's the way I think of my work, you know, that. And I think if you're out there and you're trying to engage people, you know, that you've just met in an intimate way and you know, really have access to some of their interior dialogue, that you have to be able to risk on the page, you know, your own inadequacies and your own foibles and your own sometimes brilliant ideas. You know, you have to be as intimate as you're portraying the people that you're writing about.
Well, I think you succeeded, and you know, there's a lot to talk about in the book. Obviously, even in a half an hour conversation, we couldn't cover. But you drove. The other thing I noticed was you ultimately drove 6,000 miles, and yet in the writing, I never felt that sense that I often feel driving long distance of sheer exhaustion, which you must have felt along the way. So you left out. The bad parts, you know, if you will, the sort of, you know, just the things that didn't really matter, which is a lot of moving around before you do come to something that's interesting.
I remember an interview I read with Elmore Leonard years ago where he said, you know, when he started writing the kind of stuff that he's writing, he'd have so much trouble because he had to move people from one room to the next, you know, or from one state to the next. And he finally decided there was no point now, and he just left all that stuff out, and then his work soared, you know. And I think particularly with a book that's at least part travel book, that it's easy enough to fall into the trap of trying to report everything, you know. I mean,
right, you can't. It won't work. It then becomes, you know, more like a travelogue rather than a meditation.
Well, you're telling a story, you know, whether you're writing fiction or writing fact, it seems to me. And any good story has to move along as quickly as you can make it. Well, that's not always true. But,
no,
I mean, there are books that demand to be read very slowly.
Right, it does need to have an arc. You do need to get someplace, and the reader has to be able to go with you. So if you go too slowly, which is certainly possible to do in a travel book, I think, you know, you can overwhelm people with detail. But, you know, there's so many places that you went. I think you talked about some of the ones that stood out. Jefferson City, I think, was one. And then you seem to be pretty interested in the Eastern Shore of Maryland. To summarize, you started in New York City, picked up a rental car at JFK, and which I think is also amazing. I can't imagine what the rental car company thought of this when you dropped it off with 6,000 miles on it.
Not a dent on it.
That's pretty good. I guess that's another question. You know, you're traveling alone for 6,000 miles. I guess the obvious question, do you ever feel lonely and kind of wishing that, you know, there were more people to engage with along the way that you actually knew?
Oh, absolutely. And there are places in the book where I say that. I believe there's one in Ouray, Colorado, which is a very pretty sort of alpine town way up in the San Juan Mountains. And I got there in, I guess it was probably early October, and you could feel winter coming, and the sky was dark, and I was sure there was going to be a blizzard, and I wouldn't make it to San Francisco in time. And I say, you know, I'd been reading throughout the trip, you know, about people like, I was very interested in very American writers, and so I'd been reading a lot of Thoreau, and I couldn't read Thoreau because he sounded cranky, and Emerson was lecturing, and I said, and as to Travels with Charlie, I couldn't bear to open it. You know, it was just.
Yeah, I think at that point you were fatigued.
I was fatigued. I mean, there's another point where I, you know, I sort of blame Steinbeck and say, I wish I never got that book, you know, because here I am stuck in wherever I was stuck in, you know. But yeah, they're of course, but in strictly narrative terms, they're not bad moments, you know.
Right. Well, you know, everything can't be beautiful, and everything,
mm-hmm.
Neither your own, you know, story nor the country itself. Not every place is wonderful, or you know, are you going to find pithy moments and, you know, really interesting people? I think, you know, in some places, either you just didn't happen to meet the right people to have a good story, or, you know, it was a bad day for you, and it's going to be projected on the experiences that you have.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you're dealing with snapshots. You know, I never set out to prove a theory, and I think often with books like this, you know, people kind of sell an idea to a publisher, and then go about proving the conclusion, you know, that they've been paid to conclude, and that sort of work has never really interested me. So you know, I'm quite happy to, you know, take the side roads and see where it goes. But you're right, in terms of travel, as everybody knows from their own experience, it's colored by, you know, where you are on excuse me, on the mental map that day.
Right, and then sort of the randomness of experience.
Mm-hmm.
And probably the weather. I mean, I think you picked a really good time of year to do it. You know, you don't want to go in the winter crossing America, and maybe even the summer could be difficult. So fall or spring makes sense, and you've got some very beautiful days, and you got to some places which are beautiful inherently, and had some great experiences there.
Yeah, well, interestingly, that was another problem that Steinbeck had. You know, he started, I mean, he by the time he was ready to leave from Sag Harbor, he was, his initial sort of optimism had fled, and he was really a bit terrified of what he'd set for himself, the job he'd set for himself. And he headed north to New England, and it tended to really accentuate the kind of depression that he was undergoing. He ran right into winter. You know, he found the New Englanders very reluctant to talk to him about anything, and so his loneliness just really sort of spiked right at the beginning of the journey.
Well, and of course, you're a different person than he is. So, for your experience, you didn't start depressed. You know, I don't think you shared with him this kind of sense of loss or failure. Maybe at that particular stage in his career, I think he was, you know, he was also worried about his own ability to tell the story that he wanted to tell.
Well, and he was working on things. But I think too, to some extent, he'd become spoiled by fame. You know, that he was moving when you read the letters, you know, he's moving in you know, Hollywood circles, and he's moving among celebrities. And you know, I think, I mean, really, what he was trying to do, when you read everything closely, he was trying to recreate the moment when he set out in his old bakery truck and went through the San Joaquin Valley. To write newspaper articles about the plight of the Okies for a San Francisco paper. And you know, all of that trip turned into The Grapes of Wrath. All the raw material came from that trip, and his sense of moral outrage, and it was engaged. And the Travels with Charlie was he says in the letters that he hopes to come back reborn, and he was really out to recapture that sort of youthful idealism that I think he had lost, and which is common enough, you know, as people age.
Well, then that sort of raises a question for, you know, about you. Do you feel that when you were younger and traveling, I assume you did, you know, a fair amount of traveling then, you know, how does it differ? Do you feel less optimistic, less hopeful now, you know, just in general,
well,
or are you still pretty much, you know, seeing things the way you did earlier?
Well, it's different, you know. I mean, I think when I conclude and I get to the to San Francisco, I talk about the first time I ever drove cross-country when I was 26 years old, and I'd been in the Peace Corps, and I'd been teaching at a boarding school for kids with learning and emotional disabilities, and the sense of optimism and freedom I got when I hit San Francisco in 1969, at the tail end of the whole hippie thing. You know, we believed in those days you could do anything, you know. I mean, anything could be changed, anything could be bettered. And I arrived this time, you know, whatever, 40 years later, thinking, you know, maybe not everything, you know, but that there's still a lot of good things going on. One thing that happens, I think, too, is you realize how to be in contact with young people, teenagers, you know, talking to them in the midst of this financial morass. You know, they don't know from 401ks. You know, they're thinking about nanotechnology, you know, and all the benefits to mankind that's going to bring. So there's just a sort of eternal recycling of things, I think, you know.
Well, I think that's true. You know, you can tell if you spend time with anyone teenaged or early 20s that optimism and hopefulness and the idea that almost anything is possible still remains. And, of course, San Francisco in that era, that you were there, and I guess maybe into some years later, is sort of the epicenter of all of those possibilities spun together. Maybe moving north, you know, into Northern California too, where new communities were formed and a lot of people were living then, who were trying different ways of you know, trying to be human.
Mm-hmm.
Do you when you got back to San Francisco, did you still feel like you were coming back to a place that you were familiar with?
Well, no. I mean, for me, it's a bit like, you know, there's a famous Fitzgerald essay about my lost city. You know, when he talks about New York, I mean, the city had changed so much. You know, that it's still a lovely place, but it wasn't my city anymore. But that air, because San Francisco was and is an Obama kind of town. After the election, there was this wonderful buoyancy and sense of possibility. And I say in the book, I think that for me, I wasn't able to buy into it quite so wholeheartedly because of what I'd experienced, you know, in driving across the country, that I knew that there was going to be a lot of resistance to change, really.
Well, and that comes across in the book. I thought that was pretty interesting that you felt, in, especially moving across the country, you know, in the middle, that sense that, you know, culturally you were in a place where people were thinking differently. They had different ideas than you do. You know, you talked a lot about the Rush Limbaugh talk radioization of people's minds where, you know, as you said, I think in one line, an otherwise common sense a person who is speaking in otherwise common sense terms all of a sudden would launch into a canned discussion that came straight from a right-wing talk radio guy.
You know, it was really sort of heartbreaking, you know, because on the simplest level, you know, we all have so much in common, you know, and you're talking to somebody about their kids or your family or then the conversation, because it was such a heated period before the election, would turn to politics, and the same person that you were feeling an emotional bond with would go off, and you know, I don't think I was upset that people had a different opinion. It was that the opinion was this, you know, parroted version of all the stuff I just heard on the radio 20 minutes before.
Right.
So it's
kind of depressing to realize that people are not able to think for themselves.
Well, I mean, you know, I think it comes down to education. I mean, and public education is such the money it's just not there in the proportion it ought to be. You know, if you want an educated electorate and you want an educated democratic country, then it seems to me that question has to be addressed.
Well, that's true, and I think in many places in the country, you know, we don't see an education system that's built to teach people how to think. It's built to teach people how to learn by rote, and I think that's a real, you know, off topic, I guess, from the subject of your book, but it is, it's a really big issue for us.
You know, it is, and, you know, the other thing, I mean, which I realized after the fact was, you know, that I was sensing or running into the early manifestations of what's become the Tea Party. And part of the reason, you know, that, I mean, the demographic says these are, you know, largely older white Republican men at the spearhead of the movement. And, you know, I think whether they understand it consciously or not, it's true that they're no longer going to hold the power that they once held. You know, the U.S. Census Bureau says that by 2048, or estimates by 2048, we will be the white people. I mean, we will be really, truly a nation of minorities. You know, and I think that that's psychologically very difficult for some people to handle.
Right. Well, yeah, I think people who have felt empowered and a sense of power in their culture feel threatened when other cultures and other lifestyle, you know, other value systems become ascended.
Mm-hmm.
Or
when the country becomes what it was set up to become.
Right.
You know?
Right. A group of multiple value, you know, multiple or differentiated cultural values. But you know, again, that sort of that tension has existed probably from the beginning.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And probably will continue. Well, so you still live most of the year or all of the year in Ireland?
I have been until recently. Now I'm in Los Angeles for at least a year to work on a new TV series that David Milch is developing.
Right. I wanted to ask you about that. This you have. I mean, one of the themes in the book is your angling, your interest in fishing, fly fishing in particular. And of course, you don't really mention horses in this book, but that's something that you've written about in the past. So were you recruited to work on Milch's racetrack television show?
Well, yeah. I mean, I had actually done a script for him. We met years ago, and I did something for him on NYPD Blue. But he knows my book, Laughing in the Hills. I mean, really, we see the track in the same way as a kind of world unto itself. And so he did, as they say here, reach out when he was getting ready to start doing this project in earnest. And so we've been working away, and the pilot was shot in, when was it, April, at Santa Anita, directed by Michael Mann, with Dustin Hoffman and Nick Nolte and a cast of, you know, really good actors. And so now we're going to series, and this is all the language I've acquired in the past 3 months. you know, working on the, I don't know whether they're going to be 8 episodes or 12, but we're working toward a year's worth of TV.
Well, so you get to experience the, I think the classic literary writer goes to Hollywood story.
Well, yeah, it is classic in some ways, but the thing is that Milch is such a literary person, you know, and so unusual for, you know, in my experience of this business, and that he works very organically. I mean, he goes through a script, approaches a script the way I would approach a novel or even a book of nonfiction, without any particular, you know, most everything here is done, is formatted. You know, people want to know, this is what's going to happen in episode 2, this is in 3 and 4 and 5, and he doesn't really know, and I don't really know, and you start fumbling around and working with characters and kind of allowing them to bump up against other characters. So in that sense, it's generative writing. You know, it's not in terms of the overarching view or I don't want to use the word like hypothesis. The story we're trying to tell, we kind of understand the nature of it, but the particulars are worked out on a daily basis.
Right, it sounds actually much more like the way a serious writer would work, and therefore appropriate, I think, for your work.
So well, hopefully, yeah.
Yeah, well, no, it sounds interesting. I'm sure a lot of people that are hearing this are going to be interested in watching that show.
Let's hope.
We hope. And but to go back to the story, at hand, I want to thank you for talking to me about The Long Way Home on the trail of Steinbeck's America, which is really, I think, on the trail of Bill Berich's America, and I think it's a terrific book. Thanks for talking to me.
Well, thank you.
This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast and talking to Bill Berich.